History Out Loud, Chat from the Stacks, a podcast by Caldale Libraries. Presented by Jill Carpenter. Welcome back to History Out Loud, listeners, and welcome Jill Liddington.
It's nice to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad you're here. Jill lives in Caldale. She's an author and a historian, author of Female Fortune, published in 1998, which was the book that inspired Sally Wainwright to write Gentleman Jack. And today she's going to be talking to us about her new book, which was published on the 7th of March, As Good as a Marriage, Anne Lister's Diaries, 1836 to 1838. So I've read my advance copy, which was kindly sent to me by Manchester University Press, and I thought it was fascinating and I really enjoyed reading it. I found it compelling, but also disturbing as well. To begin with, I'm sure there's very few people who haven't heard of Anne Lister now, but I'd like to start with just a brief introduction of Anne Lister as a diarist, and also to ask Jill how she became interested in her.
Well, I moved to Halifax in 1980 and I was busy doing other things, but I quite soon got interested in Anne Lister of Shibden Hall, who wrote the most amazing diary. It started a sort of schoolgirl diary when she was 15 in 1806, and then it stretched almost without a single day missing until her death in 1840. So the count of words is now nearing 5 million. Wow. To begin with, it was thought to be 2 million. Then I did a calculation myself in 1990, and it came out as 4 million. And now the diaries are digitalized, it seems to be much nearer 5 million. And what's great about the diaries, as well as Gentleman Jack and that global fame, is that in 2011, it was recognized by UNESCO in its memory of the world record for the UK, along with diarists like Samuel Pepys. So Anne Lister as a diarist is up there with the best.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say, I think her word count, does it exceed Samuel Pepys? It does, doesn't it?
By far, it exceeds Samuel Pepys. Samuel Pepys did not write at the age of 15 till death age 49.
It's quite some going, it really is. There have been several, as you say in the book, pioneer editors of the diaries and letters. Can you briefly introduce some of those people?
I can, and say, you know, what heroic work they did. It starts, of course, with John Lister and Lister's indirect descendant, who was the last Lister to live in Shibden Hall. He was a scholar. He was a historian and antiquarian. And he began in the 1880s to transcribe the diaries. His edited transcripts were then published in the weekly Halifax Guardian over a number of years. But of course, he couldn't crack the code, and that wasn't cracked till about 1892, when he worked with a fellow antiquarian and they managed to crack it. And of course, in that time, late Victorian England, male homosexuality was punished extremely harshly.
Yes.
Since the 1885 Act. So the diaries were put back behind the panels and a silence followed. John Lister died in 1833. Muriel Green, the daughter of the borough librarian, was given the job of sorting through the voluminous papers at Shibden. And this is her work in the late 1930s. She transcribed not all the letters and Lister letters, but a very significant proportion of them. And that's in her librarian's dissertation thesis in Halifax Library.
Yeah.
And then she went on to produce a small book or selected number of letters.
We should say that the key to the code at this point, it was locked away, wasn't it, in a safe?
In her father, Edward Green's safe.
Yes.
Because the librarian was advised that because the matter was so controversial, dangerous. The law didn't touch female homosexuality, but it certainly still touched and criminalised male homosexuality, and that's where the key to the code remained. The next scholar to work on the Annalista Diaries was Phyllis Ramsden, who was allowed to have the key to the code and allowed to borrow two volumes of the diaries to take home. And she worked mainly on the coded sections of the diary because she now had the key to the code. Mm. Sadly, only her summaries of those coded sections survive in the archives. I think her full transcriptions may have been burnt around the time of her death in the 1980s. The next person to work on this particular section of the diaries, and we're interested in the middle late 1830s, right, in As Good as a Marriage, was an American scholar interested in LGBT history, who was a PhD student at York University.
Kat Euler.
She was very thorough and very gifted, and she produced her PhD in the 1990s. But she looked just at the three, or she focused particularly on the three election years, 1832, 1835, and 1837. So we don't get continuity. And I should have said that John Lister also focused on the election years. So the years between elections, you get sort of gaps. And then finally, as Gentleman Jack was about to come out, a German LGBT scholar called Angela Steedel produced a book called Gentleman Jack. And it's the one book that has the whole of Ann Lister's life between one set of covers in one volume. But the problem is she relied entirely on secondary sources. So for the early Ann Lister, she relied on Helena Whitbread's book from 1988. For the 1830s, she relied on my first book, Female Fortune, which covered the early, mid-1830s. And then for the travels, she relied on Phyllis Ramsden's articles. So it's been controversial, that book. So there are the five pioneer editors. And I think what came out of that survey of looking at them is we really still needed detailed work on these neglected years, apart from the election year 1837, the years 1836 to 1838. These are the years that give us an absolute insight into the dynamics of a lesbian marriage at Shibden Hall in Halifax in early Victorian England. So I was very glad to plunge in.
Yeah. Since these books have been written, we've also had an explosion of the internet and an explosion of Ann Lister related research. We should mention there's been a few groups that have been active in working to decode the diaries. West Yorkshire Archives, Ann Lister Codebreakers, Packed with Potential, In Search of Ann Walker. So these have all been helpful, I suppose. Would you agree?
I think they've all been very helpful, and they were all, I think it's fair to say, all triggered by the success of Sally Wainwright's Gentleman Jack in spring 2019. Incredibly useful, and they spread the word about Ann Lister far and wide across the globe. I get tweets from places I can't spell, I can scarcely pronounce, and I just can't read the language. Obviously, mainly America, United States and Canada. However, because I'm a historian, I strongly believe that Ann Lister can only be understood in her historical context. And if we rip her out of her context and try and see her in terms of our 21st century values, we kind of miss a lot of the point of her. I have taken 2 years, May 1836 to May 1838, to focus on and to go through very carefully, and not just the diaries, but also the letters, which give us another perspective on Ann Lister's social relationships. And also, you'll have noticed that I quote from the local paper, because Anne Lister and Anne Walker, while at Shibden as a settled married couple, read newspapers, Anne Lister particularly, and very revealing that Anne Lister often spends 2 hours reading the paper.
I particularly liked when I was reading the book that they read the paper out loud to each other as well, which is something we don't tend to do so much these days.
No, I think it's a bit like we might watch television together.
Yeah.
It's communal, it's friendly, it's affectionate, it's shared time, it's companionate, and it's what happens in a good marriage. And they do spend a lot of their evenings either reading silently or reading together. Both of them writing their diaries, and there's a lot of references in these couple of years to Anne Walker writing her diary.
Yeah. So these 2 years that you've covered in the book, it starts in May 1836. This is where Female Fortune ends, isn't it? So you pick it up from there. When did you decide to tackle these 2 years that everyone else has avoided?
Can I take you back 3 years to early spring 2020? My diary was packed with Anne Lister and Gentleman Jack events. On the 11th of March, I went to Halifax Town Hall to take part in the Freedom of the Borough ceremony for Sally Wainwright, which was very, very nice, very well deserved and enjoyable.
Yeah.
And on the 18th of March, I had a talk planned in Hebden Bridge with Happy Valley Pride called Writing Anne Lister, an LGBTQ plus history. Between the 11th of March, Town Hall, and the 18th of March, Hebden Bridge, the world changed. COVID hit and everything was cancelled. I just went through my diary, just crossing things out, and it was very traumatic for all of us. An American woman from New York State called Pat Escate was the lead organiser for Anne Lister Birthday Week, which was going to be the first week of April. And we were all busy looking forward to that and committed. And that was cancelled. There were no planes. And we all kind of went, ugh. But Pat, being very full of initiative, said, well, if we can't do it in person, let's do it on this newfangled thing called Zoom. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, Zoom. And she interviewed Helena Whitbread and I think Sally Wainwright as well, and then me. And her final question was, so are you writing another book about Anne Lister? And I was all in a state of absolute emotional shock about COVID and the lockdown, as was everybody. So I just rather weakly said, no, I'm not, but I hope other people will be doing that.
Mm.
And then what happened is COVID went on and the lockdown went on. And all our plans for, oh, I could do something over the next couple of weeks became a couple of months. And in fact, then a couple of years. It suddenly dawned on me that the only thing I could do was start again writing another Anne Lister book. So it was to be a sequel to Female Fortune, which, as you say, ends in May 1836 with the death of her father. So it would start then and it would go on for another 2 years till Anne and Anne went to France. So I went back to my early 1990s plus notes, which were all very ancient technology of, do you remember microfilm?
Oh, we still use them in the library.
Printouts from microfilm, which are dark grey on pale grey. Luckily, one of the things that happened was that the diaries had been digitalised by then, in part thanks to Sally Wainwright's generosity. Gradually, the idea for the book took shape, and I went back to my publisher who published my last book, Manchester University Press, and my then editor, Emma Brennan, who's now editorial director. And I was absolutely delighted when she said, yes, please. And before the summer was out, I'd signed a contract with MUP for As Good as a Marriage. And I think both of us were very pleased with that. So that's how the book started.
Given how prolific she is as a diarist, even with just covering 2 years, it's a daunting amount of material. You say in your introduction, good editing is a fine balance between what the reader wants to know and what they need to know. So how did you decide what to leave in and what to keep out?
In a way, I had to be fairly ruthless because, I mean, the book is a substantial book. It runs to about 350 pages, and I have left an awful lot out. What I decided to leave out, and this is a decision I made back in the early 1990s, was the landscaping detail that we don't need to know how many barrows of soil were pulled or how many one horse carts were pulled up Old Bank from Halifax up to Shibden. Nor do we necessarily need to know all the details of her mining activity, because unless you are an economic historian or an industrial historian, they are mind-boggling. So I was quite ruthless with that. Mm-hmm. And I didn't necessarily include all the names of sort of small tenants, et cetera, or minor friendships. But what I tried to do was to retain the key relationships. The key relationship was obviously with Anne Walker, and that is the focus of the book. I also needed to keep in her key business relationships, which was with her Halifax lawyer, Robert Parker, whose office was down by the Peace Hall in what was known as Square. And with her banker was now Mr. McCain, whose bank was, but isn't anymore, out at the back of the old Marks and Spencers, if you can remember where that is.
I'm not sure.
Some people who've lived in Halifax longer will remember the back of the old Marks and Spencers leading up to George Square. That's where she went for business. And then, of course, on the estate itself, Samuel Washington, and I wanted to include key details of her estate business, like the development of Northgate into a hotel with a casino. And I wanted to keep her key relationships. She was very good at networking. So her befriending of elderly Lady Stuart was very important, because Lady Stuart, besides having a soft spot for Unusual Anne Lister, was her entree to all these other fascinating women, Lady Stuart de Rossay, Lady Cameron, etc., etc. I've given good space to the letters,
yes,
which a lot of editors seem not to do, and so they miss a whole dimension of Anne Lister's life, which is how she portrayed herself in public to these titled women. They were aristocratic, but minor aristocracy, very important. And I've also included other documentation like the Halifax Guardian, and also some of the things she was reading. I mean, she was the most prolific reader. Mm. I mean, if it was new, she'd go and read it. She'd either go down to the private library in Halifax, or might more likely go to Whitley and Booth's in the centre of town and buy a book. Because thanks to her marriage to Anne Walker, she now could afford to buy books.
And get them bound as well.
And get them bound as well, yes, in the best binding.
Yeah. I think it's good that you've included these aspects in the book, because it adds a lovely contrast to the actual diary entries and the coded passages.
Yeah.
You've added your editorial voice throughout, for clarity, which I found brilliant. And I was so grateful for it, because it's so intense. It's very intense. And it was good to have you there breaking it up.
Well, thanks very much. I really appreciate you saying that, Jill, because that wasn't always easy to do, because what I didn't want to do was impose my opinions on the reader. What I tried to do was to say, this is the context. This is what's in the diary. This is what's in the letters. Please, dear reader, make up your own mind.
Yeah, it comes across like that. I was really in admiration of how objective you were.
I always try and be balanced.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So on to the actual book itself. So for context, where do we find Anne Walker and Anne Lister at the start of the book in May 1836?
Well, it's just after the death of Anne Lister's father. And just after Anne's sister, Marion Lister, moves out of Shibden Hall and goes to live where their mother's family came from in East Yorkshire with a woman companion. I won't say banished, that Anne Lister banished her sister, because that's too harsh, but I would suspect that Marianne Lister, now her father was no longer there, just didn't feel she was welcome.
Yeah.
And so she left, and she never came back to Shibden. Anne's beloved aunt, Anne, is now pretty ill. She's elderly and ill, and really in the next coming months, bedridden. Anne is devoted to her. So after Anne Lister's aunt's death in the autumn, apart from their servants, Anne Lister and Anne Walker are on their own in Shibden Hall. They have the run of magnificent Shibden Hall. So we can really see in these next couple of years a lesbian marriage, a dissident marriage, close up in detail, in vivid, intimate, riveting detail.
Yeah. You say the book explores whether it was a good marriage, in other words, as good as a heterosexual marriage in the early 19th century. What do you think were the main challenges facing them at this time in history?
I mean, at that time, conventionally heterosexually married women had very few rights. Divorce was nigh impossible. Married women's property rights had yet to be talked about. Women's university education was not even on the horizon in the 1830s. So life was quite difficult, quite challenging for conventionally married women. And ironically, the one sort of safe space legally for a marriage was a lesbian marriage. Nobody, of course, talked about that, but homosexual activity, as we know, was legally condemned. A lesbian marriage was, of course, recognised by neither church, no church at all, nor by the state in laws. So it was a sort of free space. But, and it's a very, very big but, there was no guidance. There was no social etiquette books as to how to conduct it. And I think that made it quite difficult, particularly for Anne Walker. They were both observant Anglicans. No Sunday would go past without them either saying prayers by their aunt's bed or in Shibden, or more usually going to the church at Lightcliffe for the afternoon service. So they're both very observant Christians, Anglicans. For Anne Lister, she believed, she knew that God had created her the way he wanted. He wanted her nature to be as it was. Anne Walker was plagued by more guilt, and that made it very, very difficult. And may I just give a short reading from the diary on this?
Yes, yes, please do.
This is just a little insight into, as well as the happy times that they shared together, and they did. There were some unhappy times, and these were sort of up and down a bit. It was quite a volatile relationship. And this is June 1836. And I'm going to read from the code, so I might just whisper it a little bit. June the 6th. Found her at luncheon, fretting at having taken more wine after I left her. She has had 3 or 4 glasses, and so much is too much. Poor thing, what a waste of happiness. We must get off. And then the next day, Tuesday the 7th of June, no kiss, this is when they're in bed, but a very good attempt at play last night and at grubbling, that would be a caressing this morning. She owning it was not that she disliked it or that she did not like me, but she thought it was wrong, and that in part is a religious wrong. It will end in our ever getting together again, query. So we just see very clearly there Anne Lister having no doubts about her sexuality, and Walker being plagued by religious doubts. And we also see that, as well as the happy times in their shared life at Shibden, their shared married life at Shibden, Anne Walker did drink much more than Anne Lister. And one of the things that is kind of amusing in the diary, is that once they had got married, which was Easter 1834, so they'd been married for over 2 years now, Anne Lister was beginning to have access to Anne Walker's income stream, and Anne Walker, having inherited half the Cronest estate by Lightcliffe, which is enormous, there was money there. And as well as hiring extra servants, like you must have a groom and you must have a footman in livery, you also have to dig a wine cellar and fill the wine cellar with very expensive wines. Marsala and Madeira seem to figure quite largely. And that passage I read was not untypical of Anne Walker getting slightly tipsy in her feeling of not being completely in control, I think.
Yeah, there's also a lot of references I noticed to Anne Lister giving her a drink and a biscuit, a glass of wine and a biscuit, almost like as a pacifier, really.
Yes.
When things got very emotional.
Yeah. But it's worth saying, as well as that, they enjoyed happy times at Shibden. And there's one rather nice passage I'd just like to read to you. And it's an example, and a sort of slightly rare example of a very happy marriage. They go to Sorby, where a mutual friend related to Anne Walker, but also Anne Lister had a friendly relationship through Mariana with her earlier. Mrs. Henry Priestley would have us sit down and partake of her good family dinner, and her own good humour and quiet good-heartedness made all agreeable. We stayed 50 minutes, which was a long social visit for Anne and Anne, and Walker too was comfortable, and I am always more at ease here at the house called Hoff End in Sorby than I am anywhere else hereabouts. And they also, of course, have visits to York to see friends or lawyers, and up to the Dales, and as we'll find out, to France. So there were some very happy times in that marriage.
Throughout the diary, she says at the beginning of each entry, and this is in code, no kiss. And this is a reference to no intimacy between her, sexual intimacy between her and Anne Walker. I noticed that towards the end of the book, that this no kiss just stopped appearing altogether. There are less coded passages in this book than there are in Female Fortune, aren't there? And less reference to sexual activity. Why do you think this is?
I think it's because in Female Fortune, I was talking about Anne Lister coming back from Hastings, having been betrayed by yet one more woman's conventional marriage plans, despondent, lonely, and casting around for a life companion, and her attention alighted on Anne Walker, wealthy heiress of Cronest Estate. And what followed was wooing and seduction in the moss hut which she'd had built. And then that then led in spring 1834 to the betrothal. So there's a lot going on, and Anne Lister's wooing and seducing skills were impressive, and she was a dynamic companion, and she magnetised Anne Walker, who was really quite lonely. She just had an elderly aunt and an older cousin in Lightcliffe for company, and suddenly here was dynamic Anne Lister. By the time we meet them, it had become more of a companionate marriage. So I think what we notice is that there are certain moments when they're sexual relationship becomes much warmer and much more intimate. One was when they were able to travel. So they go up to the Dales at one point. And always when they're away from Shibden, and Walker feels freer, I might say less shackled by Anne Lister's passionate, absolute, almost obsessive focus on her estate business, and they can relax together. The other time, or amongst the other times, when their sexual relationship just became much more enjoyable again, was when there was a common enemy. So the most regular common enemy was political, the Whigs, who had a habit of winning elections and getting their MP into Parliament, both in the small new Halifax constituency, which still elected two MPs, and in the old sprawling West Riding constituency, rural constituency, which elected more MPs. And Anne Lister and Anne Walker bonded together in doorstepping their tenants.
So nevertheless, and we've said there are less coded passages in this book than there was in Female Fortune. Nevertheless, the content within these passages is quite disturbing in places. Were you shocked with what you read?
I was the first time I read it. Mm. Yeah, I was shocked. And I'm just going to give you, if I may, just a little reading from one of the more shocking passages. This is July 1837, Friday the 30th. They're having breakfast together at Shibden, and it's in codes. She's talking just to Anne Walker. Began gravely with the assurance that Anne Walker should have no trouble with me. She had only to do as she liked. She began crying. I changed my manner, said all this was ridiculous. She wanted a good whipping, and I got to be right. I told her I must buy a rod. I must buy a rod. And in truth, I must not indulge her too much. Said I should take her by Hull to Rotterdam and Paris the end of the month, and she made no objection. And Anne Lister then goes out again on her estate business. So a good whipping and buying a rod is just cruel, cruel words. And Lister was always the more adventurous traveller, always keener to be away and travelling in Europe, out to Russia. And she's got it all planned to Rotterdam and Paris by the end of next month. And Anne Walker made no objection, possibly because of the threat of the rod and the whip.
There's another little bit as well, that which is actually something that Anne Walker herself has said. I suppose we have to keep in mind very strongly that the diary is all from Anne Lister's point of view, and we get very little input from Anne Walker. But she leaves a note for Anne, and this is on June the 29th, 1837. In the note, she says, "Little one is very much obliged to you for all you have done for it." And that, it made me feel so sad, really, reading that, because in a sense, it's like, it feels to me like somebody who's quite trodden down with how she feels. Not necessarily that Anne Lister has caused this, but this is how she feels as a person, referring to herself as it and little one.
Yes, I mean, I found that quite disturbing when I first read it. And at the betrothal, it is Anne Walker agrees to be under no authority but mine, i.e. Anne Lister's. And you think, goodness me. But then you just think what heterosexual marriages were like, and how few rights married women had legally at that time. Yes, it is tricky. I think what's interesting is Anne Lister's writing this very candidly and revealingly in code in her diaries, and yet her behaviour isn't necessarily cruel like that, nor some people have tried to say it was coercive control. I would say that's an overstatement, because when we actually get to what Anne Lister does, her behaviour, she never does leave Anne Walker at all. And we might just mention, when Mariana Lawton comes to visit in autumn 1836, quite soon after Anne Lister's aunt has died, she's hoping that she could make some intimacy again with Anne Lister. And she tries to involve her with, this is all in code, loose-lipped kisses. But Anne Lister will have nothing to do with it and just reservedly withdraws. And Mariana realises that Anne Lister's primary allegiance is to Anne Walker, and that it is a lifetime union, as Anne Lister intended. So I think we just need to keep a balance when reading these rather disturbing passages in code in the diary as to what's actually happening in the handwritten parts of the diary, that they're getting on with their lives.
I guess as well, a lot of the talk within the coded entries, it's diminutive. It's all little one, little thing and everything. But this could be pet talk in a way as well.
Yes, I think so.
And there is a, so, is it a 10-year age gap between the two of them?
Yes.
Roughly. So it's very hard to say. And this is where your editorial balance comes in. We don't really know, do we? So we have to keep an open mind. And like you say, keep it in context with
yeah.
Pitt time period.
Until we find new volumes of the Anne Walker diary, because the references to Anne Walker writing her diary are through the whole of these two key years.
Looking at it from Lister's point of view, I've noticed whilst reading that she talks very much in the diary about how she talks calmly to Anne Walker when she's upset or going through an emotional episode, and other words that display a sort of calmness that she's maintaining. It's a diary, so she's not trying to convince anyone of this other than herself. So to me, it suggests that she had to anchor herself in her own calmness and ability to stay grounded in the face of what she was experiencing within the relationship.
I think that's how Anne Lister often kept control of situations with somebody she was having any tensions with, whether it was, in this case, her married partner or a business rival. That's what she did. And I think what we want to remind ourselves of is Anne Walker's history, that her parents died when she was still fairly young. Then her sister, Elizabeth, got married to Captain Sutherland and disappeared right up, not just to Scotland or Edinburgh, but way up into Invernessshire. And then 2 years later, 1830, their brother, who had inherited Crownest, married and went on his honeymoon to Naples. It was about as far south, exotically far south as you could go. There died, and there was a sort of inheritance kerfuffle because his bride was pregnant, but it turned out she gave birth to a stillborn child. All that Anne Walker had to contend with no solid relationship to give her support in the way that Anne Lister always had a beloved aunt who loved Anne to bits, and Anne was the daughter she never had. Mm. So I think there's quite a sort of complexity here. And I hope that in the diaries, both the handwritten passages, which are the main part, and the code, I give a balance. And I wanted to include quite a bit of the handwritten sections, because what Anne Lister achieves is so amazing. She completely redesigns Shibden Hall. So when we go there, there are now flags outside, as opposed to a sort of sloping field with sheep in it, and a tower out on the west wing. And she develops her coal mines, and Listerwick, by the time they set off for France in summer 1838, Listerwick is actually producing coal thanks to the hurriers.
The boys.
Who are boys who are dragging the coal underground, and the mines are narrow enough for a small boy or a teenage boy to be able to do that. So she was a person of incredible achievement.
I think it's important to mention that Anne Walker as well, she was very much involved with local schools, wasn't she?
Kind of.
Oh.
Yeah, she did keep the school books, and she did go and hear the pupils saying their catechism or a psalm or something like that. She had trouble with the schoolmaster and his wife at the school, because I think it was he drank or whatever. The difference between Anne Lister and her project, say turning Northgate House into a hotel, and Anne Walker running her little school at Lightcliffe, is that Anne Lister was on top of the situation and read everything she needed to read and employed the best people. And and Walker struggled rather with her school.
It's a hard act to follow, isn't it?
Yes.
The thing that I take home from it all is that they were complex people and their relationship was extremely complex as well. And I think people reading the diary, they're going to be a bit conflicted maybe about how they feel about each of the two women, but it's really stimulating and as I say, fascinating. So Anne Lister, she devoured books, didn't she? That was because she couldn't study and go to university. This was her way of learning about everything. And she's especially keen on geology and also travel books. She absolutely adored travel books.
She devoured Captain Cochrane's Pedestrian Journey through... He doesn't mean pedestrian in the sense of being boring. He means pedestrian. I actually walked
actually
it.
Walking, did, yeah.
Pedestrian Journey through Russia and Siberia. And she really, really wanted to go to Russia. That was really out of the question. They could only go away for a few months with Anne Walker's aunt having been ill. But luckily their doctor, Dr. Jubb, advises that for Anne Walker's health, they should visit some spas, vapor bars they're called, but we call them spas. And they therefore cross over to Paris by ship. And Anne Lister is very seasick. They move towards in their carriage towards Paris, and Anne Walker is getting quite ill. They visit a doctor who Anne knows in Paris, who says they must go down south, deep south, towards the Pyrenees, to Saint-Sever, where there are healing spas, and he will give her directions about how to take the spas. So they do that. They travel right the way through France down to the Pyrenees and stay near Saint-Sever.
So they travelled by horse and carriage all the way down through Europe?
That's right, with two servants to assist them. Anne Lister spoke very good French, and they get down towards the Pyrenees, the beautiful foothills of the Pyrenees. And this is now August 1838. And they try some climbing some foothills, some of the lower hills, and it's apparent that Anne Walker is having difficulty. So Anne Lister has set her sights on climbing Vig Merle, which is the highest peak in the French Pyrenees. And accompanied by two local guides, she sets off the first day and climbs up to a cabane where they spend overnight, and then manages the next day, well wrapped up because it's still quite cold up there, with the two guides to ascend Vig Merle. And it really is an incredible achievement for a woman.
She was dressed as still as a woman as well, wasn't she? There's a lovely, in your epilogue, there's a lovely quote from her diary saying, "I was dressed as I have been ever since my arrival, flannel waistcoat and drawers, chemise, stays, short cambric muslin under petticoat, over which striped jaconet waistcoat with light collar and long sleeves." So she goes into quite a lot of detail about what she's wearing, very, very Anne Lister.
I think it's a very helpful reminder that Anne Lister dressed discreetly. She dressed as a woman. She, even when going up Vig Merle with two French local guides, she would dress, and the word muslin appears a lot, and she's obviously wearing female dress.
Yeah. The only reference to anything that would be suitable really is strong leather quarter boots.
Yes.
it's amazing.
She does have looped tapes to loop up her skirt, because climbing so high would be very difficult with a long skirt on. So that was August 1838. And when I read this, this is just after Female Fortune had come out, I thought, wow, could I ever do that? And I found I could in 2003, because I have the good fortune to have a brother-in-law who is an experienced mountaineer. So I set off with my partner, my sister, and my brother-in-law, who was leading us. And we too set off from near Saint-Sever, where we were staying, going up, stayed in a cabin with other mountaineers, crept out quite early, it was about 6 o'clock, left at 7 o'clock, having had a breakfast, climbed up and up and up, had to put crampons on as you went over the snow, had to get roped up, got up to the top and looked around, and it was very windy. And people are surprised that Ann Lister doesn't say more about the top, but it really is too windy to
hang around.
So we were up there for about 5 minutes and then came down. And it was now late morning. And my brother-in-law said, we've got to hurry over the glacier, because as the sun comes up, it will melt the snow and there are crevasses below the glacier, and we don't want to fall into the crevasses to our death. So he went ahead. We were all roped up. I was the weakest link. I was third. And I was being urged along to hurry up. And as each step I took in my crampons and this rope, et cetera, over the glacier, and luckily over the crevasses as they melted slightly in the sunshine, I thought, I'm in absolute awe of you, Ann Lister. I have absolute respect for you, of what you managed to achieve, both as a mountaineer and as a businesswoman and as a diarist. So thank you, Ann Lister. I honour you.
There's a quote about her climbing of that mountain, which I just think is lovely. I've made each ascent for pleasure, not éclat. What is éclat to me? What is éclat to anyone?
Yeah, she did it for herself.
Yeah.
She did it for herself. And that's a much quoted couple of lines. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Jill Liddington, for coming on to talk to us on History Out Loud today about your book, As Good as a Marriage, which is published by Manchester University Press on the 7th of March, which will be before this podcast goes out. Yes, it's been brilliant and I loved reading it.
Well, thank you very much, Jill. I mean, it's absolutely delightful. You're one of the first people to come back to me who said, I've read the whole book and I really loved it. I mean, bits were disturbing, but I really enjoyed it. It was brilliant. So thank you very much, Jill, and thank you to History Out Loud.
You've been listening to History Out Loud, a podcast by Calderdale Libraries, produced and presented by Jill Carpenter. Join us next time when I'll be chatting with History Out Loud regular John Billingsley about the tale of the Mixenden treasure.